Okay, this is Billy Briggs of The Ferret. I'm here with Russell Finlay, investigative journalist, and we're going to speak about his new book, Acid Attack, A Journalist's War with Organised Crime. Thanks for your time today, Russell.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a bit about your career as an investigative journalist and who you've worked for?
Yeah, I started off in journalism in 1993, working for a local newspaper in Glasgow called The Glaswegian, which, for all that it was a fairly typical local newspaper, even at that stage we did the odd investigative type thing. For example, there was an occasion where there was a housing association official who was selling out the back door tins of EU meat that was supposed to be distributed to residents in Anderston. We bought crate loads of this stuff from him, and he was ultimately convicted of theft. So from there, 2 years at the local newspaper, went to the Sunday Mail, and investigative stories were very much part of what they did and what they continue to do. And I spent many, many years there until around about 2014, when I ended up going to the Scottish Sun as investigations editor.
Okay. Can you explain why you decided to focus on organised crime?
Well, it wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't wake up one day and think I was going to start writing about gangsters or criminals. I've got no time for them. I think there has been a tendency for some in journalism to glamorise them, or it's almost like football reporters being a little bit too awestruck by it all. But I can probably place it to the early 2000s when security firms were popping up all over central Scotland. These were very often just fronts for organised crime. They were involved in protection rackets, they were money laundering, they were drug dealing, and it was like a who's who of the criminal underworld. From doing an occasional story about those involved, it would generate yet more. There was also, around about the same period, at the Sunday Mail, the boss at the time wanted to do a piece on crime. It was a blank page. It was an ideas session. What could we come up with? And I made the point that we were so used to hearing about a fairly two-dimensional aspect of crime in Scotland. There was the baddies and the cops were the goodies, and the words organised crime weren't really used. There was no real awareness about money laundering. But anyone in society could see that there was very wealthy individuals who were what we would now term organised criminals. Their reach wasn't just in the housing schemes of Glasgow and elsewhere, but they were sending their kids to private schools, they were laundering their money in businesses that you and I use, private hire taxis and everything else. And from that came a series in the Sunday Mail called Crime Inc., which was quite a good name for it because it was looking at the money, it was looking at the scale of these organisations, and not, or at least certainly not intending to glamorise or promote them. It upset them because we were looking at their company directorships, their connections with the legitimate spheres in politics and elsewhere.
Your book, Acid Attack, explains the acid attack you suffered in Christmas 2015?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you explain what happened that day?
Yeah, it was a quiet early morning, 8:30 or so, 2 days before Christmas, the first day of the school holidays. I was in bed reading a book. The door went. I thought it was one of my neighbours. When I got downstairs, I could see through the door a sort of red shape of a jacket, or a person wearing a red jacket. Slowly opened the door gradually, and the man said he was a postman, Royal Mail, had a delivery. He passed me a card to sign, which was a Royal Mail card, and as I leaned down to sign it, I felt liquid splashing onto the right hand side of my face at some force. This was followed almost immediately by an empty bottle that flew past my head, and then followed instantly by the man himself, who came through the door at me. I was at home alone with my daughter, who was 10. Even though I didn't know at that point it was sulfuric acid, and even though I didn't know at that point what the man's full intent was, I managed to get him out the door. I was wearing just pyjamas, I was barefooted, I had a t-shirt on. We fell outside. I managed to subdue him. He was removing what was a legitimate Royal Mail jacket in order to try and get away. I think in the book I describe it as a snake shedding its skin. He, at this point, my daughter appeared at the door to see this scene of horror, me fighting, effectively fighting for my life. The police eventually arrived. In the meantime, one of my neighbours came out and assisted. Another neighbour then got a basin of cold water, which I was throwing onto my face in order to get the liquid away from me. I was asking questions of my assailant, including what he'd thrown at me. He wasn't seeing anything. Eventually the police came. When the police took him into the van and handcuffed him, it was only then that I spotted there was a knife across the threshold of the front door. So almost certainly that was meant for me. It should have been an acid attack and a stabbing. So thankfully it was just an acid attack.
And your attacker was a guy called William Basil Burns. Can you talk a wee bit about him?
Yeah, he's a career criminal. He's a man in his mid to late 50s who has presumably had every chance to rehabilitate himself and has chosen never to do so. He was imprisoned round about 2001 for 15 years for shooting a woman during an armed robbery. This woman was a security guard who was going about her business, and he shot her for a fairly small sum of money. At that point, the judge told him he may get life for this, but instead he got 15 years. He got released after around about 10. This was done in secret, as is the norm. It only came to public's attention because another journalist wrote a story about him being returned to prison for breaching his license. He nonetheless was released again, and at this point, when he attacked me in December 2015, he was still subject to the 15-year sentence that had been applied, that still had another 7 or 8 months to run. So his criminal history includes using a gun to steal a Lion King birthday cake from Marks and Spencer, which is really, in terms of the stupidity of these people, pretty unique. He's also stood trial for a murder where he was acquitted. The police believe that he did commit that murder. I think it's probably likely he did. But he has made a career for himself from his base in Paisley of being an individual who will do anything to anyone for money. And on this occasion, that was me.
Okay, and he was found guilty of the attack last year.
Yeah, it took 18 months, but he was found guilty. He was caught at the scene of the crime. The police turned up. He was there, present with the Royal Mail uniform, the bottle of acid, the knife, and he was found guilty. Summer 2017.
And what sentence did he receive for that?
Well, it's a not particularly straight answer to that. As I was initially led to believe, he was sentenced in Aberdeen, so there was no scope for me to go up. I wasn't going to lose a day of my life going to watch that happening. But the first I knew of it was when the judicial office tweeted that he was getting an extended sentence of 15 years. I then looked at the linked 500-word statement from the judge, and within that was that 15 years meant 10 years in custody and 5 years extended supervision after the 10 years had expired. Again, I wasn't clear what they meant by 10 years. Was that a guaranteed 10 years in custody? And I asked the Crown Office. It took them a while to come back to me and say that because of the length of the sentence, the individual can apply for parole after half. So therefore, he could apply for parole after 5. He'd spent a year in remand at the point of sentencing, which means, theoretically at least, he could be released 4 years after being sentenced. So was he sentenced to 15 years, 10 years, or 4 years? It's not really clear.
Okay. Your book talks about the system in Scotland. Now, as a reporter, you've reported on the criminal justice system for more than 20 years now. You raise certain concerns within the book. Now, what's your main concern about the way Police Scotland handled your case?
Well, with my case, I've got no quarrel with the officers that dealt with William Burns. Detective Sergeant Craig Warren was professional and courteous. He investigated that quite properly. What I was concerned about is, having given my initial statement, which focused entirely on the events that took place on that morning, no one in the police thought to come back to me and ask who may have had an involvement in this. Did I have any information or theories about organised criminals who might have been responsible for this? There was just no interest. I then contacted them a week later to say, to raise these questions. I had a meeting with a senior CID officer who listened to everything I told him, including specific intelligence in relation to where the attack may have come from. Again, another week passed and nothing happened, and I suspected that a decision had been made, that they had their man in custody. It looked like an open and shut case, and there wasn't really an appetite to look beyond that. So I wrote a letter to the Chief Constable and to the Solicitor General, raising these concerns and highlighting some of the information I had about who might have been responsible for the attack. They reacted to the letter, they took statements from me and other people, but I got the impression that there wasn't really an interest in investigating this in any significant way. I think that was a missed opportunity. I think not so much because of it being me, but because this was an attack by organised crime on a journalist, a pretty audacious attack. We've seen journalists in other parts of the world getting killed and targeted by organised crime. Close to home, we've had Veronica Guerin in Ireland, we've had Martin O'Hagan in Northern Ireland, and I think for all that I wasn't badly injured, and for all that they had the perpetrator in custody, this should have been a bit of a red line. I think that's how I describe it in the book. I think the police and the Crown and even the politicians should have put some pressure in terms of trying to get to who was behind it, rather than just leaving it at that.
Do you hope that the book then will provide some impetus for a further investigation into the person?
I don't really expect so. I don't think it will change anything. I think the only likelihood of that would be if William Burns was to come clean about who had paid him. I don't think he's ever going to do that. He's a career criminal who keeps his mouth shut. So, you never know. I can live in hope, but I wouldn't have thought so.
You raised some other points about the criminal justice system. You talk about legal aid, and you rail against criminals getting legal aid, and you argue that the system should be scrapped and replaced with a network of public defenders. Can you explain how that might work in practice and why you've come to that conclusion?
Indeed. Well, first of all, I think most people have become completely, almost immune to the fact, story after story, year after year, serious organised criminals who the Crown argue are worth huge sums of money, yet another branch of the state, the Scottish Legal Aid Board, pay legal bills in the tens, twenty, thousands of pounds, and it just isn't right. I imagine lots of solicitors who do legal aid work, I know they're not making a lot of money. I know that it's not what it was, but you could say the same about journalism or many other jobs. But I think if you look at the budget of the Legal Aid Board, the amount that's spent every year on criminal legal aid, it's about £150 million. And that's quite a reduction from a high of a few years ago where it was, I think, about £170 million mark. If you take the number of solicitors in Scotland that actually do legal aid work, it's a decent sum of money. I don't buy the argument that they are living in penury. I think that it's still too generous. I think if people didn't have the means to pay for a solicitor, other countries have systems where public defenders could act in their behalf. And I think that would be a much better way, both in terms of taxpayers' money, but also in terms of the justice system itself. I think there's no incentive in solicitors to conclude a case. I think if they're in receipt of legal aid, there can be a tendency to churn it, and that's one of the blights of the criminal justice system. So many court cases are beset by delays, and I find the legal aid thing to stick in the throat of people, and it should be addressed.
You also are critical of judges in the book. You describe them as, quote, scowling tyrants who wield dictatorial power in courts. I mean, what reforms would you like to see regarding the judiciary in Scotland?
Yeah, I mean obviously most judges are very wise, reasonable, honest and fair, and the book is quite hard-hitting, but it shouldn't detract from that. But I think if you look at the judiciary in Scotland, there was the creation of a post called the Judicial Complaints Reviewer. In England and Wales, there's an ombudsman type system for judicial complaints, and it's quite a stark difference between the two regimes. The first Judicial Complaints Reviewer resigned because, in her words, it was a toothless watchdog. There is no meaningful redress from a member of the public. I think that perhaps the politicians are slightly fearful. Nobody wants politicians meddling in the judiciary. An independent judiciary is absolutely vital, and no one's sensibly arguing to the contrary. But I think more could be done in terms of their accountability and transparency. There's been a petition before the Scottish Parliament for the past 5 years now calling for a judicial register of interests, and that's resulted in a judicial register of recusals being published voluntarily by the judiciary, which just shows that some individuals who have got good arguments can make a difference. But I think there's still more to be done in terms of just, in the judiciary's own words, drag themselves into the modern world.
You also attack the Crown Office, describing it as, quote, borderline dysfunctional. What's your main criticism of the Crown generally and in relation to your own case?
Well, in relation to my own case, I think the Crown, I think what's quite often overlooked is the police investigate crime, but very much at the direction of the Crown or in liaison with the Crown. And therefore, in my case, there was the appetite not to look beyond William Burns. The Crown may have had a handle in that. Also, in relation to my case with the Crown, my case was as open as shut as could be. You have a career criminal out on licence, caught at the scene of the crime with the Royal Mail uniform, the knife was present. He could have been prosecuted very quickly and very easily. But to my surprise, he eventually emerged that he was being charged with a shooting of an individual outside a school in Bishop Briggs. This shooting related to the Lyons v Daniel drug war. I surmised in letters at the time to the Crown that this complicated my case. It meant that my compelling open and shut prosecution was going to be cobbled on to a fairly murky gangland incident in which presumably there was very little evidence. I thought it was quite a cynical tactic by the Crown that they would take my case and use it to carry the other case. I made these points to the Crown, and when the first trial collapsed, I was very annoyed because it was directly in connection with the other matter. When the second trial eventually ran, 6 months after the first, after hearing the evidence in relation to the other crime, that part of it was dropped, which absolutely proved that the points I'd been making at the outset were correct. They should have just focused on my crime, and if at some point down the line there was enough to prosecute the other case, they could have done so. More generally in relation to crime, the Crown Office in Scotland employs something like 530 solicitors. We're told routinely that they're far too overworked and it's the system's in chaos. We've had judges and Lord Advocates year on year talking about churn. Nothing's ever done to address it. But fundamentally, it's about transparency and accountability. If you look at cases like Harry Clark and the Bin Laden prosecution, where at the heart of it was this never properly explained decision not to prosecute. If you look at the amount of cases where plea deals take place, which might be sensible, but the public don't know if they're sensible, they've no way of measuring it, because not only do the deals not get announced, they certainly don't explain how they've arrived at them. The statistics, when you look at prosecution rates, a large number of cases don't end up going to court. The ones that do end up getting delayed. And I think so much could be done politically to try and make the Crown more efficient. But first and foremost, transparency and accountability.
Yeah. You used the term churn there, which you document in the book. Could you just explain what that is?
Yeah, it's a word that there's not been a huge deal written about, but it's been a problem for a long time. And it's where criminal cases go to court and they are beset by delays. Quite often it can be defence lawyers finding every reason possible, some legitimate, some not so much, to delay a case. The reason for that is it keeps their client free for longer. It can cause witnesses to fade away, lose their memory, change their minds. It can weary a prosecutor to the point where they may be more agreeable to a deal. It can also be caused by the Crown itself not being prepared, not having disclosed material. We've seen cases in England recently where rape cases where the Crown Prosecution Service didn't disclose evidence, and in Scotland I'm familiar with cases where similar happens far too often. When it's supposed to be enshrined that disclosure happens, it doesn't, and cases are often delayed because of that. So that churn is all those things, but it's delay, and it's not in my words, but in the words of people in the book, judges and so on, inimical to justice.
Your book documents on two occasions you received Osman warnings from the police. Can you explain what they are?
Yeah, there was a case in London, a businessman with the surname of Osman, who had been, the police were in possession of clear threats against this individual, but they did not pass them on, and the man ended up being murdered. I think it was his family then took the police to court, and the consequence was that it was accepted that if the police were in possession of tangible threats against an individual, they were duty-bound in law to pass them on. I've had two formal warnings. The first one was quite a long time ago, probably the early 2000s, and it related to the McGovern family, which is a family from North Glasgow, a crime family. I'd been writing about them and their involvement in private security, their feud with another criminal, which resulted in a murder of one of the McGoverns, and the police at that point took me in and told me that they had intelligence to suggest my life was in danger. The second occasion was actually following on from the acid attack. There was an arrest made of another man in relation to the acid attack, and around about that time the police came to me and said they had cause to believe that I was in danger of some sort. They have got a template document that they bring out in these occasions, which they ask you to sign, and you can't help but feel this is just a bit of a back covering exercise. You know, you've been made aware of the threat. They obviously can't tell you who's made the threat, they can't tell you what the threat is, they can't tell you how serious or otherwise it might be, but they've told you, so it's kind of on you. And there's a line in it that kind of sticks in the throat, which says that you shouldn't break the law and take the law into your own hands, or words to that effect. So these are designed for criminals who are involved in feuds. So when a member of the public or a journalist like myself gets one and it has that line, it's quite jarring, because, you know, we're not in the business of taking the law into her own hands.
Regarding threats, a colleague at the Sun newspaper where you worked never passed on a threat that was made against you. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that now? And was that ever explained to your satisfaction?
No, it was after the attack, about a week after the attack, I became aware that quite a significant threat had been withheld from me. Now, this is detailed in the book, and it's quite a difficult subject to write about because journalists talking about journalists might not be the easiest thing to do. The threat was sufficiently serious for me to raise it with the police. A certain individual who's named in the book had expressed a deep hostility towards me, and had also, more worryingly, divulged to my colleague personal details about my vehicle, my whereabouts, and other personal information that I learned about a week after the attack. It was quite shocking because the original threat was 10 months prior, and he hadn't passed it on. So the person who withheld it, I don't have any malice towards. I'm not angry at them. I think they made a very poor judgment, but I don't think they did so out of malice either. I think they did so just because the person who'd made the threat to them, they felt slightly conflicted. They didn't quite know what to do with it. It's never really been properly explained as to why it was withheld, but hopefully the book, if anyone in journalism or newspapers or even in any walk of life does hear about a threat being made about against someone, even if it is a hollow threat, it should be passed on and shared with the individual. I think that's just common sense.
I mean, following that revelation, you ended up seeking medical treatment. You explain that in the book. Emotionally, how were you at that point, and how are you now?
Medically, in the physical side of things, I had a very serious eye injury. It was touch and go as to whether I'd be blind in one eye. Thankfully, 6 months later, after the event, it was diagnosed as being absolutely fine. My skin healed very quickly, probably largely due to getting water on it so quickly. This was sulfuric acid. This burned through the enamel paint and the radiator in the hull. In terms of my mental state, I think you, at the time, you underestimate the pressure that you're under. Your mind is racing. You've been subject to a very traumatic event, and I needed time out, and I went to a doctor and had to take a significant period of time off work just in order to get my head straight. And it wasn't something I was comfortable with. I think in the book I say, you know, initial period of 6 weeks felt like forever, but that it was longer than I needed. But thankfully, in terms of my mental state, I'm absolutely fine. I'm conscious, as I was before the attack, of strange faces, of my security, of these kinds of thing, but I've not suffered any long-term effect medically, either physical or mental.
Your daughter witnessed the attack.
Yes.
How has this affected her?
Again, she has been extraordinary because she raised the alarm at the age of 10. She suffered a terrible fright. She witnessed something that no child should have to suffer. But she is as bold as brass. She is absolutely fine. We don't dwell on it, but you know, she can take some pride in it if the subject ever does come up. What probably contributed towards that was when she came downstairs and saw what was going on, she could have come down to a different scene altogether, which would have been me stabbed, dead or dying. The individual who, with Mr. Burns, may have got away and may still have never been caught. So I think from a child's perspective, and I think the book describes it as being like a movie style ending, I was okay. The baddie was caught at the scene and was thrown in prison. And, you know, put simply, the goodies won and the baddies lost. So from a child's perspective, I think that has probably been a huge factor in how we all are now.
Your book will be published when?
February 22nd.
Okay, and it'll be available online?
Or? Yeah, it'll be on Amazon. It's from the publisher Berlin, Edinburgh-based publisher. It'll be on Amazon, and it'll be in presumably most good bookshops. So, yeah.
Okay, great stuff. Thanks very much, Russell Finlay.
Thank you, Billy. Thank you.